And a high fly ball deep to left, and forget that. That is way out of here off the bat of Bo Bichette up into the second deck. Another mammoth home run in this series. We saw Alonso hit one into that second deck last night, and Bichette tonight, his 17th home run, makes it 7-3 Toronto, their fourth home run of the night.
What a pivot for the New York Mets. Less than 24 hours after losing out on Kyle Tucker, they swoop in, go bold, and sign up Bo Bichette to a 3-year deal. I mused about this last night when they lost Kyle Tucker. Figured the Mets would still be in play for the big free agents, and I wondered if Bo Bichette would be a guy that they could pivot to and rethink third base, and it seems like that's exactly what the Mets have done. So many things to like about this move, not the least of which is, in all likelihood, it takes him away from the Phillies. If the Mets didn't sign him, there were a lot of rumblings that Bo Bichette was heading to Philadelphia. So that, first and foremost, a big deal. This is a guy that has been a clutch hitter at every stage of his career. I have the numbers right here. A career 330 hitter with a 904 OPS with runners in scoring position. Those are career numbers for Bo Bichette, a type of player that the Mets desperately missed a season ago. As for the fit, like I said, likely third base. That means Brett Baty, who the Mets believe is a very versatile and athletic player, will get moved around the diamond. Play some third, play some second as we've seen, but also get some time at first base maybe. Maybe move him to the outfield, play some left field as well. So Brett Baty becomes kind of that super utility guy as of right now. But once again, huge move, huge pivot, Bo Bichette, a New York Met.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Saturday morning, January 17th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and come join me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Free chat, interaction, premium content, updates on the show, and hey, you can even interact with me all at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I would love to thank the folks at the Believe Network for supporting this show. Yes, I'm back, and I almost came to you earlier yesterday, but I was afraid with how wild and wacky the baseball offseason has been, especially the last, 72-plus hours. I was like, if I come with the second show just hours after we had kind of the whole Kyle Tucker, Dodgers dynasty scenario, Mets fans flipping out, unfairly torching Steve Cohen and David Stearns, I'm like, well, if I come with a reaction to the crazy news about the Mets signing Bo Bichette to a 3-year, $126 million offer, and then they make another move, I'm just going to be doing radio all day. Well, maybe, and that's not a bad thing for some of you that like me, but it also gets a little bit clumsy. So I said, let me see some of the information that comes out about Bichette, about the Mets, about this move. And as always, I always like to take a step back, even if it's for a few hours, because it makes for such a better show. I'm going to say this before, and I'm going to tell you a funny story about a connection with Bo Bichette. Personal connection to me. Very, very, very 6 degrees of separation, by the way. Don't get too excited. But I have not seen an offseason like this maybe ever in baseball, at least since I've been watching the sport. And in the modern free agency world, this has been wacky from, and maybe I'm just talking from a Mets perspective, but even in general with the way the sport heading for some labor issues, the whole Pete Alonso, Edwin Diaz drama, leaving, Diaz going to the Dodgers, the whining, the complaining, the Nimmo trade, the inactivity, the fact that, I have to tell you, we all kind of had speculation about what the Mets were going to do throughout the offseason, and I think most of it earlier in the offseason was about bringing back Alonso and Diaz and building out from there. But who the hell would have ever had this scenario about the Mets going after Kyle Tucker, losing out on Kyle Tucker within a few hours, less than 24 hours of losing out on Kyle Tucker, pivoting for a player, Bo Bichette, that there was no smoke around. And then really that tells you a lot about the Mets front office. The only real leaks that you've had this offseason have been connected to really the Tucker contract, which maybe that was not even the Mets front office. I'm guessing that was probably more on the Casey Close agent side, if I had to take a guess. And all the stuff about the clubhouse and all that nonsense, that was leaked. That's probably coming from a former coach. We probably know who that most likely is, who's been chatty all offseason. We'll keep that aside. We don't want to rehash that. But have you ever, I mean, Bo Bichette is about to put pen to paper with the Phillies on a 7-year deal. And, oh, by the way, the phone rings. Hold up. The Mets. Oh, it's the Mets on the line. Hey, Bo, don't sign that just yet. We might have something here. And the Mets not only get a very important offensive piece, a right-handed bat, something that we've talked about them needing, something that was one of the impetuses of me saying, hey, overpay for Alonso, not just because of the home run, the prodigious home runs, not because of the homegrown scenario. Hey, by the way, you need a right-handed bat. But who would have thought about Bo Bichette? We briefly broached on him early in the offseason, maybe as a second baseman. But then once the Marcus Semien trade came down for Nimmo, I'm like, oh, well, that there's that. They're not going to certainly bring him on for Lindor at short. And even if they didn't have Lindor, with his lower body injury history and his lack of defensive prowess, shortstop's probably not the spot where you want him going forward as he gets into his, you know, prime and then 30s and all that other stuff. So I have never seen such wildness. I thought the reaction of the Phillies fans, I don't know if you guys have gone on social media and saw there was a Phillies podcast, there was a video, and they actually saw the news while they're on the air. We don't really do that here. I mean, the closest thing we've had to that, and I don't really do a lot of video at all, actually, any video at all, but was when the Nimmo trade came down in the middle of our mailbag. I mean, that's the closest thing, and it is pretty funny. And look, you don't want to, and I'm not going to be a phony here, because just 24 hours ago I was talking about the offseason's not about winning or losing the offseason. It's about building your team. It's a business side of the sport, and the business side of the sport that is entertaining in a world of social media and a world of where, look, content and entertainment has to fill every minute of our day, or we're not satisfied anymore. It's kind of an insidious path, maybe the road to hell, if you ask me. But, you know, look, I benefit from it, so why should I complain? And here they go. All this stuff happens, and it's fun. I mean, I'll say this. I'm not going to be a phony and say, you know, this is the greatest thing. But it's really interesting. It's been a weird offseason. So let me give you a quick funny story. Maybe you'll think it's funny. A connection with Bo Bichette. So you guys all know, I'm sure you know, and if you don't, I'll tell you now, Dante Bichette is Bo Bichette's father, and Dante Bichette was a big league outfielder, mainly known for his time in Colorado during the 90s, who played for Boston and Cincinnati, came up with Milwaukee and played in Anaheim. So he had a pretty long career, and he was a good hitter. But let's face it, he was a good hitter who became a very good elite hitter in the offensive enhanced confines of Colorado. Now, for the younger fans who maybe were too young to appreciate baseball in the 90s, let's not assume, because if you're listening in your early 20s, you didn't have any chance to watch any baseball in the 90s. Colorado, what you see today with the balls and the humidor or whatever else they're doing to quell the offense there, which has been going on for a while, maybe two decades. That is not the ballpark that fans, opposing fans, Mets fans, let's just talk Mets fans, experienced during the 1990s. You would go there and no lead was safe. 7-0 lead in the first inning, that's 1-0 in Colorado. A spacious outfield, ball flies, a lineup with Larry Walker and Andres Galarraga and Bichette, and I mean, even guys like Eric Young Sr., I should say. I mean, everybody hit home runs there. Charlie Hayes. It was a wild situation. Even the year they played in Mile High Stadium, that one year, their inaugural season, that it was wild. So I think I've mentioned this before. When I was young, I was lucky enough, occasionally, my dad, through his business contacts, there was a company that had seats, two rows behind the visiting dugout at Shea Stadium. And in the early to mid-90s, when the Mets are not so good, it was very easy to get those tickets. Nobody wanted them. And we would go on maybe a Friday night or a Saturday night. Usually a weekend, my dad would try to get tickets. And it wouldn't be against a prime opponent. It would be against whoever we could get. And for somebody who didn't get a chance to go to the ballpark more than maybe once a year as a young kid, I mean, we didn't have season tickets. We didn't have that kind of money to be able to go out and really splurge. Even back then when the ball game was affordable, this was gold. Like, this is great. I'm 14, 15, 16. So in 1996, now I'm in college. So now I'm a wise guy, right? Friday night, and I actually looked at the box score on Baseball Reference. So this is true, this story. I remember it. There's certain things you remember when you go to a ball game. I remember this. So the Mets are early season, 96, Generation K. This is before the whole thing fizzled out. They were excited. Mets, post-strike. I had just gone to the opening day game with Ordóñez throwing from his knees a couple of weeks earlier. This is mid to late April. And the Rockies are in town on a Friday night, probably about 20,000 people there, maybe less. It was always, Shea Stadium, when City Field, we've seen it, when the Mets are not playing well, that could be somewhat of an empty, cold environment. But the passionate fans, the fans that show up, are always into it. So when you're down by the dugout, two rows behind, you hear a lot. You see a lot. You see guys popping out of the dugout. You see guys talking to fans, especially in the corner part of the dugout as you get further down towards home plate, where those guys, whoever sits in those front row seats that you could see on TV, right in that nook, right to maybe like behind the right-handed, because it's a visitor dugout, behind the right-hander's part of the box, they could even just talk to the guys sit right there in the corner of the dugout. So Dante Bichette was the object of my heckling. And it was fun heckling. I didn't curse or anything like that. We didn't do stuff like that. We knew we were trying to be a little bit more gentlemanly. So Dante Bichette is playing for the Rockies that day. And the big thing, if you remember, about a year earlier, Bichette annoyed me because you probably have seen this recently with the signing of his son. He hit a grand slam home run off the Mets on opening day, Colorado 95. He did the fist pump. And it just always annoyed me. He was kind of one of those guys that looking back, he's doing nothing wrong. The hot dogging you saw then was nothing like now. So all night, getting on his case, Pete Harnish was pitching. The only reason I know that, I looked it up at Baseball Reference. And I'm yelling, Bichette, you can't hit. This isn't Colorado. And earlier in the game, I'm looking here to see. I think he got a hit earlier in the game, and then he lined out. But we were razzing him the whole game. So Mets up. Mets are up 3-2, fifth inning, two outs, nobody on. Quit McCracken gets a triple. And now there's a run on third, two outs, and Bichette's up. And right away I go into my shtick. And Bichette, I don't think he's hearing me. And Bichette, you stink, this and that. You can't hit. This isn't Colorado. Next pitch by Harnish, boom. And I could still see the ball. Well deep into the bleachers in left field. Home run. Larry Walker wound up hitting home run right after, too. Back-to-back, a belly-to-belly. But as Bichette comes back from touching home plate, walking towards the steps of the dugout, he looks up at me, does the little finger with the home run side, and blows a kiss, basically saying, screw you, Talking Mets and Mike Silva. This is way before Talking Mets. And corny, I know, but kind of funny. And needless to say, I didn't say anything the rest of the game. But for the rest of his career, I never forgot that. So I always was one of those that... And the stats proved it out. I mean, he had an OPS that year. I looked it up, under 700 on the road. It was like almost 1,000 at Coors Field. So anyway, non sequitur. You don't want to hear it. The funny other part was that there was a connection about 15 years later when I was doing the NY Baseball Digest website. And that was when I was doing both teams. When the Yankees signed... Bo's brother Dante Jr., and I wrote about that, and I told the story that I just told you in print. Like, his mom, Mariana Bichette, jumped in and had like something to say in the comments section. And I was like, the mom, and at first, if it's Dante Bichette gets on my case, it's at Shea Stadium. Now the mom is, and I didn't say anything negative about Dante Jr. I just pointed out, hey, hopefully he's not like his father who couldn't hit anywhere but Colorado. And she didn't like that I said he couldn't hit anywhere at Colorado. But by the way, Dante Bichette was a solid big leaguer. He wasn't a guy that would have put up the numbers he did in Colorado elsewhere, but he still was a solid hitter. Anyway, you don't want to hear any more about young Mike Silva and his antics at Mets games in the 90s. You want to hear about Bo Bichette. So when I first heard the move for this, I right away thought back to Carlos Correa, the middle of the night, Cohen signing that big contract after the physical was failed in San Francisco. I always felt, and that was an exciting night, and the Mets needed a bat, and they were going to take a shortstop, put him at third. And I said, hey, the Mets need to leverage that 2022 season. They need that bat. They need to use the largesse. And Correa was an elite hitter. And good thing that fell apart. But I always felt, and if you go back and listen, I always felt that that was never Billy Epler. That was Scott Boras, and I think the story was out there. John Heyman talked about it. Scott Boras basically texted Cohen while Cohen was having margaritas in, I think it was Hawaii or somewhere warm over holiday vacation. And he said, hey, you want to get involved in this? And Cohen's like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I'm a few in. I got some dough to play. It was almost like, you know, when these wealthy guys get into these high-stake poker games. Yeah, I'll play. So let's just throw $300 million down on Carlos Correa. So it reminded me of that. But that's where I would have, and that was my concern, because when I had talked about the response to the Tucker situation, my point yesterday was, don't just go out and make a move for the sake of it. That's how you start to become a bad team. That's how you do something that you'll regret. It's like, don't do something tonight you're going to regret in the morning, even though it feels good tonight. And it really, when I first saw the news pop up, and I was in the middle of doing a bunch of things on a Friday afternoon, and I have the great folks at MetFix have those great alerts, they pop up. Well, I mean, they've broken two stories this year for me. Edwin Diaz while I'm driving on the Major Deegan in front of Yankee Stadium, nonetheless, I get that. And then, this Bo Bichette stuff. So I see that, and I'm like, oh, this just doesn't, what kind of fit? What are they doing here? They already got a second baseman. Are they bringing him in as a DH? And I'm looking through the whole thing. And as you start to go through it, and Will Salmon at The Athletic doing great work with reporting here, one of the best on the beat, probably the best right now on the beat, talks about how they laid the groundwork on at the GM meetings, that there was always a desire to connect with Bichette as a third baseman. And the plan was basically, it sounds like, Kyle Tucker and Bichette, and maybe that's why, because everybody had Bichette in Philadelphia. It sounded like Bichette was about to sign a 7-year deal in Philadelphia. The Mets probably already had the short-term framework, and they just said, hey, look, we need to get this Tucker thing sorted out. And once that fell apart, they pivoted right to Bichette. So the plan all along was to have Bichette play third. Now, it makes some sense, because all along when they went after Tucker, we kept saying, and I kept saying, like, that's a very left-handed lineup. Granted, Tucker is not one that has bad splits. But it didn't make sense because I'm like, all right, Polanco's a switch hitter. Lindor's a switch hitter. You're relying a lot on Alvarez, a catcher, to be your big righty bat. Simeon is right now at this point in his career. Yes, he's a righty bat. He's had 40 home run seasons, but you're relying more on the glove now. Later in his career, post-major injury, Soto's lefty. Taylor is not a bat. Taylor's a component defensive player. Benj, if he makes the team, is lefty. And we have had that conversation. And then maybe component players like Austin Hayes have come up. So it does make sense that this was their plan. They needed to bring in a righty bat. What was interesting in the comment was the Mets all along have wanted to bring in a star. And that, to me, makes me start to wonder and also get concerned that Cohen is very aware of the noise, and Stern came out publicly this past week about the noise regarding fans not happy about how things have gone down this offseason. Fans want offseason competition. They want you to be involved. And the fans, and I think a lot of this has to do maybe, and I don't know the age of the fans because not all of them are young. I don't want to paint with a broad brush here. But I think there's a generation of fans, especially if they're younger, who are economically illiterate about how a lot of economics works, and they see wealth and money and Cohen and baseball owners and baseball players, and it's, I'm going to dust off a term that those who have been listening to me for a long time I've used, especially earlier in the Cohen years, checkbook baseball, because it's fun in January to win, and or in the middle of the day get a text, a tweet, an alert from the guys at Mets Fix that the Mets just signed the guy that is a really good player. Now, it all settles down when the player doesn't perform, or in June, you're looking at the roster and you're like, ugh, this didn't work out, or this didn't age well, which would have been the case with Correa. So when I read that, I'm like, well, are the Mets just doing this? Is this a reaction to what happened? Because that's not making me happy. That's not why you hired David Stearns. Are you just signing guys to shut the fans up? Because, fine, if Cohen wants to lose money, that's his money. It's his right. He has to fill the ballpark. But you don't know what the rules are going to be. I mean, there's some crazy stuff being thrown out there where there's speculation that not only are the owners, and I think it was Nico Horner came out and already said, hey, we're not going to strike. They're going to lock us out. The players are going to make the owners the bad guys here. Negotiation-wise, that's smart. I mean, these people say, hey, they're really hardened about this salary cap, especially post-Tucker going to the Dodgers. They're willing to shut the sport down for a couple of years. Look, that was where the sport was going in the mid-90s. That sport, there was no guarantee, you know, and even the president, President Clinton got involved, if you remember, trying to get these guys together. There was a chance that these guys, there were owners that were ready to sit that thing out all of 95 and really try to break the union. So, you know, there's a lot of crazy stuff out there being talked about. And, you know, when I see this, I'm like, well, maybe they're going all in because this sport's about to go to hell in a handbag. But when you really start to peel the onion a little bit, the plan was all along to bring in a couple of big bats. And I think part of this, especially because, and the Dodgers are doing it, and I think this is going back to the luxury tax scenario, because that's the part that we don't necessarily factor in. Because I think the number came out with Bo Bichette, with the 110% tax the Mets are over now, and they're well over the third repeat offender. Bo Bichette's going to cost them, when the tax is all said and done, about $80-something million dollars this year. So they're paying a lot. He's not worth $80 million, but they're looking at it where, hey, you're looking at the total tax pie. We're breaking it down by one player. So, I mean, clearly at this point, and this is where I'm wondering, between the Tucker deal and the Bichette deal, Stearns may need a couple of more years of seasoning in his minor league farm system to really be able to start to incorporate those cost-controlled high-upside players. Or he just doesn't think his players that he has now, because we don't know if Benj is ready, and we don't know if A.J. Ewing is going to be ready, and we certainly don't know if Jet Williams is going to be ready. The only one we know that has shown, at least in a small sample size, that's ready is Nolan McClain, and that's a big one in the rotation. Maybe he doesn't think his players are actually that good. I thought Brett Beatty was on the precipice of being a really solid, above average, maybe borderline all-star third baseman. Granted, he's lefty. Goes back to that. Bo Bichette's, there already. So maybe he's looking at this and saying, hey, I just don't have the... Or maybe it's even something where they've sat down and they've said, hey, we could churn out a farm system, and we could use that farm system to bring in established stars and take away some of the variability that prospects bring. Maybe that's part of it. And yeah, maybe there's a few that we'll hold on to, whether it be around the fringes of the roster, to round up the roster cost effectively so we don't have to spend a zillion dollars on backups or bullpen and stuff. But I don't want to take a chance that Brett Beatty's going to be a solid big leaguer, or that Carson Benj is going to be Nick Markakis or better. I just want the guarantee. I want to win now. And Cohen also is probably not tone deaf. He's seeing how the Q rating is bad. And there's no doubt between the media information and the way that the fans behave on social media and how the media flames it, it's going to hurt business at the gate. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Doesn't matter how balanced and how those that listen to me appreciate the balance. I don't have the megaphone that some of these blowhards, these untalented, myopic blowhards that don't understand baseball have at different radio stations and, in the case, print or digital newspaper. So, I guess the big takeaway, as I kind of dive in different directions here, I really thought I had figured out what the Mets' plan is. And I still think the Mets' plan is to procure a strong farm system. I mean, there's no doubt about that. There's no question about that. But was David Stearns saying, hey, let me bring the young kids along. And he felt confident that he could bring back Diaz. And maybe the there was a fact that he thought he could, in whatever the market was going to be able to bring in a star and be a little more tempered. And then all of a sudden, and this is a very speculative, of course, when the whole Alonso Diaz thing went sideways, the fan anger, the media caving in on them made him say, hey, I can't do this. And that's part of the shame of being an executive in New York. You can't do things like Milwaukee because of that. See, you're in Milwaukee, you're in Pittsburgh, you can hang out and actually run a baseball team. Here, you run a baseball team, but then you have the duality of, how do I keep the fans and the media, those stakeholders, happy? And as much as I could sit here and say, screw them, do it your way, and I really think that is right, and I think you all know deep down it's right, you got to realize that they pay the bills too, and the gate matters, and the media is not going to, at this point, unless things change, and I think that's where we had the conversation about Martino coming on board, working for the Mets, the media is not going to send the proper message about, hey, this is what these guys are doing. This is how a successful baseball teams are run. And let's also face it, fair. Let's be fair to the media. Let's be fair to the fans that are complaining. Baseball team building is not sexy and it's not sellable and it's not something that attracts eyeballs in today's generation. And I'm not sure it did even back then, but I remember I go back to that early 90s Mets team I talked about when I went to the game and heckled Bichette's father. I was excited about Generation K and finally seeing some young players after the doldrums of 2 to 3 years, but it was a different generation. So to the point now of what did the Mets get? Now we've kind of laid out, I've told you some stories, I've told you that I'm confused, I've talked about Cohen and my concerns about the checkbook baseball, and it's fun, but is it leading to something else? What did the Mets get in Bichette? So what they got is a pretty damn good player. And I think that when you take away the 2024 season, where he only played half the season, and I do understand there's some risk. He's got a history of knee injuries, soft tissue, lower body injuries, which are never good. But when you take that all away, this is a guy that's got MVP votes in 4 of the 7 years of his career. He's made an all-star team. He's a guy that in a normal season should average 25 home runs, 90 RBIs, hit nearly 300. He's not going to play great defense. We'll see how he turns out at third base. I know there's a lot of conversations about run prevention and, well, what did Stearns mean? He's just full of you-know-what by Jettison, Nimmo, and Pete. Off the bat, they are better up the middle with the Taylor and Simeon and Lindor, and they've always been good with the catchers. I think that we don't know what's going to happen in the corners, but let's face it, Vientos is not a very high bar. So if Bichette moves from short to third, and the feeling is that, and I've read this, and there's been some talk from the national media. I also done some a little digging into historical articles, because Toronto was moving him out of shortstop if he had stuck around. I think he even played second base in a World Series, if I'm not mistaken. But they feel that even though his arm isn't great, that he could be able to translate a little better at third base. And defense at the corners, as long as it's acceptable and not a butcher. And I don't think Alonso was a butcher, but Alonso didn't have great instincts at first on certain type of plays. And Vientos, we've talked about. And I think Beatty's actually a solid third baseman. I think that that's the shame of it all, and I'll get to Beatty in a minute, that Beatty's not going to get a chance to play a lot of third base. Now, maybe Bichette, because he does have some lower body, history of lower body injuries, knee injuries and whatnot, he's going to get some time to DH. That's where you don't want to have a logjam at that position. The Mets have historically, since the DH has come to the National League, used it as rotation. Who knows? Maybe Simeon needs some time, a blow. Maybe Bichette could take some grounders at second. I think versatility is something that we've talked about in a 13-position player active roster you need. So that's all good stuff. This is a good hitter. This is a guy that's going to bring less strikeouts, more average contact. And I think the thing, and this is the part I didn't know, because I'm not spending a lot of time on Toronto, that Bichette is one of these high IQ, high energy, competitive, comes from a baseball lineage with his father, a leader type that is good in the clubhouse. And I think that when you start to see the kind of players that Stearns has brought in, he's not just bringing in pseudo coaches. He's bringing in guys that love baseball, are grinders, and maybe are going to be more focused on baseball than maybe what he felt was going on before. I still don't want to go back to all the clubhouse issues and the talk about politics, but if there indeed was, and there's enough smoke where you have to take some of it seriously, if there indeed was a feeling by Stearns that in the clubhouse, instead of, not that they're not doing their job and focusing on getting ready, I'm not saying that, but there's a more of a focus on proselytizing, talking about politics, or brooding about personal turf wars, even though I don't think that has a butkus to do with how they performed in the second half in terms of the bad pitching. I think, though, when push comes to shove, it's always better to have a team that is focused on the task at hand. And I love grinders, and I love guys that are baseball lifers, and I love guys that you could get into the trenches with. And maybe that's what he felt they needed. And maybe that's not what Nimmo and McNeil and Pete were giving. I mean, there is a certain, and I'm not saying I'm buying into this because I wanted Pete back and I loved Nimmo. But if you look at Nimmo, he's not the same hitter. He's more power hitter. So is Pete. You've brought in players that maybe have a more diversified offensive game. Will they be better? It remains to be seen. Nothing's changed, in my opinion, from a day ago. You're walking into the ultimate getting to know you phase with this ball club and this team. You are, because there's so many questions. And it's not even over. The offseason isn't over. So you're getting exactly a piece that you needed. I'm surprised they went this route because I just didn't think Bichette was a fit. I didn't think they were going to put him at third. I didn't think they were going to spend the money. I didn't think Bichette was going to sign for a shorter-term deal. I think the shorter-term deal is a thing, and it may be a thing this offseason, and then the CBA changes and it's not a thing. I mean, he turned down a 7-year deal, or reportedly a 7-year deal, to go to Philadelphia, play third base there, it sounds like, because he wasn't going to displace Trey Turner. At least I don't think he was. Trey Turner's a better shortstop. I know Trey Turner once upon a time played the outfield. I don't think that that's an option anymore. Who knows? I don't spend time worrying about the Phillies' problems to take a shorter-term deal with the Mets. And that's the other thing I think that is important. Not just the fact that now it's proven that the Mets actually have plans and pivoting. I mean, you saw the reporting. The fact that fans thought he was sleeping all season, that Cohen's trying to save money. You just don't understand how front offices work. These are competitive guys. These are guys that are always churning. These are guys that are doing very detailed strategic planning throughout the entire season. And it's not just Stearns by himself. He's got a cabinet. You learned that. That's how this Bo Bichette thing transpired in hours. That would not have happened under the Wilpons, whose budget was always floating, who had too much intrusion from above and too many people with an opinion, not just non-baseball people, but baseball people that made it a baseball version, it sounded like sometimes, of Washington, D.C. But you also have a player that actively chose the Mets. Yes, I know it's money, but he had a chance to have a long-term deal. There was reports that he loved Don Mattingly in Toronto and he wanted to be part of the Mattingly family in Philadelphia. Phillies are a good team. I heard the Mets are a mess, that nobody wants to play for them. He chose the Mets. Now, he could opt out, and I know there's some confusion on this $5 million trigger that the Mets could basically say, here's an extra $5 million and you can't opt out. So it sounds like the Mets might have him if they want an extra year, and I think that that will depend on how healthy he is and how, you know, but he has something to say about it because he's got the opt out. So you got yourself a righty bat, a dimension to the lineup that they haven't had. Power, average. He's not going to give you any speed anymore. He hasn't stolen 20 bases in quite a few years, and with knee injuries, I don't anticipate that. But who knows? Maybe he's healthier. That does concern me, the knee injury. So that's what you have. Now, what's next? What's next? I don't know. But if they were planning on, and this is, again, pure speculation, if they were planning on a Tucker Bichette duo signing, why not get involved in Bellinger? Clearly, the Yankees haven't been able to close the deal on Bellinger. Clearly, Bellinger's hanging around trying to see what else is out there. The deal the Yankees have offered, 5 years, $155 million, is very fair. I know he wants 7 years, 200. I told you he's going to want that. I know the Yankees reportedly have put opt-outs in there. So my question is, why is that deal not done? Yeah, he's waiting to see what the market is, and now Toronto might be involved. And of course, Boris isn't stupid. It was more Yankee-centric leading up into the last 24 to 48 hours. Now he might have two additional teams. And with the way the Dodgers are, who the hell knows what they're going to do? At this point, I'm not counting them out on anything, as crazy as that sounds. I think it's less likely with Bellinger, but after the Diaz surprise, the Tucker surprise, no, I'm not counting them out. Can the Mets do something crazy here? Go for the jugular, and you're already seeing it. The Yankees fans are nervous on social media. They're already playing the, oh, well, Soto regretted going to the Mets. Are you going to regret going to the Mets? I still find that so laughable. Like, they know. Yeah, Soto looks real unhappy when you see him. I think it would be very interesting, and I understand the Carson Bench situation. I still have heard enough, and I still think Carson Bench, because he's only had a cup of coffee at AAA, and yes, even Gelbs has said it on the Mets pod over at SNY. Gelbs has said that they're going to give him a real shot in spring training. But if you bring in Bellinger, now Bellinger could play first. Bellinger could play the corners. Bellinger could play center. And you have a lineup of Bellinger and Taylor and Soto, Polanco, Simeon, Lindor, Bichette, Alvarez behind the plate. And then I know that there's some questions about, okay, well, what the hell are they going to do with Vientos and Beatty and all those guys? But, you know, putting the DH side a spot aside, I told you that could be a somewhat of a rotating thing. I mean, that's a pretty damn good lineup. And it's not bad defensively. It's not perfect defensively. And, yes, they have to address the pitching. And I still think that the young pitchers are going to play into that. But that's where I'll pivot, because now what's that mean for Brett Beatty? And the word initially, and maybe this is just a way to sell him, is that Gelb's talked about it. They're not going to just give Beatty away because they want to give Beatty away. Bichette might only be here a year, and we don't know how this is going to work out. Beatty might be right back. They view Beatty after his third base, second base scenario last year, somebody who could maybe play first, maybe play the corner. I know they've talked about the outfield. First is one that has never come up. He's a guy that showed me at least how he worked at third base in a way more so than Vientos, who also worked at defense. But Beatty showed marked improvement. He's a tall guy. Ultimately, and I think it might have been Heyman or Sherman or one of these guys had said that, well, maybe Gelbs. I'm sorry if I gave the wrong person credit, that even back when Epler was GM and the Mets had a different front office, they felt that Beatty's future was at first. He certainly has the power for it. Maybe that's where this plan goes. Maybe they're like, hey, I have a first baseman of the future. His name is Brett Beatty. Or maybe Brett Beatty, on top of that, could take over some of the role that McNeil leaves. And he has that versatile, around-the-diamond, 350-at-bat guy. A guy that could hit you 15 homers, 50 RBIs, and 350 at-bats. If Bichette's on the IL for 2 weeks because of a barking knee, he could take over at third base. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, if there's the right deal, and this is what Gelb said, if there's the right deal, Beatty might be part of it. The other question about chips to the center of the table, not just Bellinger. Don't just think Bellinger here. Yeah, I know there's Framber Valdez and the pitching. I understand that. And then there's the, are they now showing you, because they just decided to blow through the tax, make this wild Bichette move, maybe even sign Bellinger, that they're like, hey, if I'm going to sign Bellinger to a 4-5 high AAV deal, I'm assuming that's what they're going to want to do. Even though it sounds like, I don't think that's what Bellinger wants, but if you give him $40 million a year for 4 years, that's, I mean, with opt-outs or whatever, I don't know if that's what he wants. You know, maybe they're going to be like, hey, screw Jet Williams and the kids, and let's just go get Tarik Skubal. We'll be able to sign him too. Let's go get Freddie Peralta. We'll be able to sign him too. I don't like ripping up prospect capital for pitchers that are on their last year. I know it, you know, I go back to Mike Hampton. Now, they got to the World Series and nearly won a championship with Mike Hampton, and he turned into, when he left for the Rockies, into David Wright. But that's not that's the exception, not the rule. That usually doesn't happen. Mike Hampton was the perfect rental at that point because of those two things. The second thing, Wright, you never could have predicted. because you got the draft pick, but you don't know what you're going to get there. I don't like giving up a lot of talent, but even with the way that the Skubal negotiations are going, where Boris is being difficult with arbitration, it seems to be getting nasty. You know, he might get $32 million this year in arbitration, and I don't know if that is in the Tigers' budget. I've heard the Ilitch, even though they have tons of money, the Ilitch family doesn't like to spend, so that might not be on their bingo card. Do the Mets go wild here, sign Bellinger, and then start ripping prospect capital for Peralta, Freddy Peralta, Skubal? I'd rather get Skubal. I'm still skeptical about Peralta, but Peralta is more cost-effective. Or trade for Peralta, because Skubal's not available, and then sign both. I mean, at this point, you can't... I'm throwing all logic out the window. All logic out the window. And what is funny is that just 24 hours after everybody criticized the Mets for being a joke, now you're hearing from a lot of pundits, former players, fans, media... Well, there's only three teams right now that are really showing, or four teams showing, that they're really serious about winning. The Mets, the Dodgers, the Cubs, and obviously Toronto. And that's a whole other conversation, the whole CBA conversation and things like that. So, I guess buckle up, because if I were going to tell you, hey, this is how the rest of the offseason goes, I don't know. Here's what I do think. I do think the Mets need to look at opportunities, and I think that that's where this team is going to go. They're going to look, I kept telling you, the strategy is being opportunistic and using money to make those opportunities reality. They did it with Bichette. They were successful. They failed with Tucker. Things went haywire with Diaz. And I'm going to leave you with this. I know that, and I've heard it from Mets fans personally. Well, all this money they spent, they could have just had Pete and Diaz. Yes, they wanted Diaz. Diaz didn't want to negotiate and come back. And they had Diaz on a short-term deal, and Diaz on a short-term deal was very comfortable going to another team. On a five-year deal, which is what he really wanted, he would have gladly come back to the Mets. And then when it comes to Pete Alonso, they did not believe in his aging, his body, his game of power. I mean, that's one thing about Bichette. He's a doubles machine. He had 45 doubles or 44 doubles last year. Hit 370 in the second half. Big World Series. Honestly, he's a more complete hitter than Pete because of the contact. I'm not saying that Pete's not a good hitter. Pete's a prodigious home run guy and RBI guy. Bichette has never had the RBI seasons yet that Pete has had. But Bichette is, as a right-handed batter, and this is how they're looking at it, a more versatile right-handed batter. And he could play multiple positions. Even if he's not great, he could play multiple positions. Pete can't. They didn't want Pete Alonso. So just, you got to get over that. I know he's the old-time Mets home run leader. I know about the polar bear. I understand the home run derby. I understand 2019. It's over. So I know that that's part of the conversation. We just got to get over it at that point. So what's next? So I was planning on coming to you and doing more Hot Stove on Sunday. The Bichette stuff happens. Bichette happens. That's the theme of the show. Bichette happens. I'm sure that's going to be something that's going to be overused by the All-Star break this year. Hopefully because he's successful. And the Hall of Fame is coming up, the Hall of Fame announcement, and there's a big Mets connection with Beltran. And then obviously I want to even talk about the Mets Hall of Fame, that the nominees that we haven't even got into this offseason. But I don't know what's going to happen in the next 24 hours. So buckle up. There will be a Sunday show. At the very least, I'm going to have some Hall of Fame conversation for you. Maybe you want to take a blow from the Hot Stove. But I think we just got to keep our eyes glued to the Twitter, to the X, to the MLB trade rumor type sites, and see what's next. Because I don't think anything is out of the realm of possibility with this club. I do not think Cohen, and I give them credit, part of me and part of me would have retreated a little bit if I was running a team and say, let's get these kids some seasoning. Let's see what we got. Let's have some fun with them. The Dodgers are tough. Yeah, it's a probabilistic weighted lottery playoff, but it's going to be hard to beat them. And this is an opportunity because you have the cover because of the Dodgers to maybe not rebuild, but like do things more the Milwaukee way. And I understand it's going to hit me at the gate, but if they win and they see some of these kids give them some hope, the fans will show up. Maybe not the casual fans, but the fans will show up. Cohen's like, no, we need to be able to go up against the best. And I'm not surprised. I always say, read Black Edge. Read about how Cohen made his millions. Forget about the ethics on the concept of that. Just look at the behavior of the competitiveness of the man on multiple fronts. And from what I understand, David Stearns is very competitive too. It's not that he's not. He's just intelligent, methodical, and he's been trained by some good baseball people that have instilled in him discipline that you as a fan don't have, me as a radio commentator slash fan do not have all the time. I think I have more than some other people, but it's hard. And obviously the casual fan has none of it. So, and the media has very little of it because, methodical and sensible is not good for business. So that's what I would say. Let's just sit back, relax. Maybe not relax, but sit back and get your popcorn out and enjoy the show. I will say this, and this is the final thought. I keep saying the final thought and I get another thought. I do believe they need to be able to keep and procure some of that farm system, even if they're going to start ripping it apart to try to beat the dynasty, beat the house and the Dodgers. Because checkbook baseball, as fun as it's been the last week, as fun as it's been over the last few seasons to wake up to some of these headlines and to be in the pursuit and to the excitement and the adrenaline of landing a Juan Soto, I do not think it's sustainable as the primary component of your core players. It's more like how the Dodgers are doing it, where they're adding to it. Now, I know that Freeman and guys like that were free agents, but the reason they were able to get to this point was because of their system, the way that they were able to build their team, have success. The Mets don't have that success. And I think that might be part of this. They're just trying to get that success where once they get that success and people are feeling good about them, they could play less checkbook baseball because they have a farm system that could allow them to balance out the swashbuckling spending with some good homegrown old school Brooklyn Dodger branch Ricky player development. Let's just call it that way. So, all right, that's all I have for you this early Saturday morning. No rest for the weary around here. Getting up early on a weekend instead of relaxing. We're talking baseball. I'm coming to you. I'm really looking forward to our Hall of Fame show. And by the way, I'm looking forward to the next how many weeks before pitchers and catchers, because the hot stove, at least in this modern game, it's not hot during the holidays. It's not hot during Thanksgiving or Christmas or during the snowstorms of December. It's hot like late January into February when we're all trying to get out of the cold into the warmth. The only warmth we're going to have here in New York over the next couple of weeks, it looks like, is going to be maybe some of the hot stove that's going to really come at us fast and furious, I think, especially over the next 7 to 10 days. All right, that's it. Thanks for joining in to another special edition of the Talking Mets podcast. As always, you can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and I'd love for you to join me over at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com, free chat, premium content, updates on the show, and of course, you can interact with me. All that at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and as always, I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I am your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy your Saturday. Hold tight. Who knows when we'll be back? We will be back, though, tomorrow, Sunday. Till then, take care, everybody.